Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Coming up on episode 291 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the Mitsubishi Outlander plug-in hybrid, the Rivian R1S, the Genesis G90, first drive of the Dodge Hornet. Ford launches an Explorer EV in Europe only. There's also a possibility of the Capri name returning on another Ford EV. Ford's got a new electric vehicle and battery plant going up in Memphis, near Memphis, Tennessee. Kia unveils the EV5 concept. And we learn a little bit more about the electric truck that Ford's going to build in Tennessee. All that and more coming up next. This is Wheel Bearings episode 291. I am Sam Abul-Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Nicole Wakelin, and we will go with Newsweek's Fast Women podcast today.
And unfortunately, Robbie texted me a couple hours ago and said he couldn't make it today. So yes, it's just the two of us today.
Just me and Sam. It's the Sam and Nicole show.
Yeah. So what have you been driving?
I have been driving I'm going to read the entire title. The 2023 Mitsubishi Outlander PHEV SEL S-AWC.
Oof.
I know, right?
That's a lot of name.
It's a lot. So basically, it's the Outlander plug-in hybrid in the SEL trim with the, what do they call it, super all-wheel control, which for the rest of us is all-wheel drive.
Yes.
So that's what I've got this week.
So, I haven't driven the new Outlander plug-in hybrid, and it's been a few years since I drove the old one. I have driven the regular four-cylinder gas engine version.
Yeah.
How is the new plug-in?
I think it's good. You know, I didn't dislike the old one. You know, I thought it was solid. This one, too, and I'm trying to look up. I just realized I have half a Monroney, so I have none of the numbers for the fuel economy and how far it goes on a charge, which I unfortunately will have to look up.
I'll do that while you talk.
Okay, while I talk. Thank you, Sans. Thank you for the assist. So I like this one. I mean, it has my only thing that I don't like about it is it's a little noisy when you're not driving in EV mode and you're just driving on the gas engine. It can get a little whiny if you really slam that accelerator down to go. Like if you really want to go, you hear a little bit. It gets a little bit whiny, but it is still responsive. Like Mitsubishi has this weird reputation. Like once upon a time, Mitsubishi is hot little fun little cars, right? Mm-hmm. And then it was like, oh, we're going to go build crossovers, and everyone's like, oh, these aren't great. These are kind of cheap. These are kind of chintzy. These aren't really. They're not great. Like they had, the, you know, it wasn't. It wasn't their forte, and it showed, I guess, is how I would say it. Now I feel like they're doing better. Like the Outlander plug-in hybrid, I would not be afraid to buy this. And it's been interesting watching people as I'm sharing stuff on social media. Like, I don't know, I would be afraid to buy a gas Mitsubishi, much less something with plug-in hybrid technology. Don't be afraid. It's fun. It's good. It actually is a decent little crossover. And I call it crossover. They're going to say SUV. But here's the other thing. This has three rows, sort of. It is like, okay, so here's
the thing to keep in mind, okay, this new generation of the Outlander is based on the Nissan Rogue platform.
Right.
And so it has the same wheelbase and it's the same length.
Exactly. And the Nissan Rogue is not a three-row SUV.
No.
Is not. So nope. You can call this an SUV. In fact, it does. My same Maroney with a giant title. Four-door SUV. It's barely an SUV. The thing is, when you put the third row in, and the cool thing is that it folds down into the cargo area in the back. The not cool thing is that it actually has a four-step process to release it from the cargo area in the back. And it's so baffling that each of the little straps you pull has a number, and then there's a little permanent little diagram stuck to it, because I got back there. I'm not kidding, Sam. I was like, what? Oh no, that, oh no, wait, that flips the second row. What? And I'm looking at the little diagram, like 1, 2, 3. Oh, push this. 3 is the headrest. Push that down. I literally had to do it like 4 times before I'm like, all right, I got this now. Like one of the straps, literally you just tug on the one strap and you kind of hear a little click. and that releases something. But unless you pull it and get a little click, it's not going to let the seats fold back down. So it's a little wonkity to, it takes a process. Once you got it, you got it. But if anybody like else goes to fold that seats down, like if you ask a friend to go fold them down or pop them up, they're gonna be like, what the heck? I can't do this. They're going to get lost. They're going to do it wrong. You can actually, because I did it, fold the seat down, but still have it open. So part of it sticks over the tailgate and you're like, nope, that can't be right. So the seats are a little funky, and there's really, honest to God, not enough room back there for everybody, for people to sit. It's only got two rows in the back. So it's a 7-passenger. I moved the middle row forward enough that I could sit in the third row, but I mean, sit so that my legs were fitting between the seat. Like there was no room. Like you could sit in, like put your legs straight down and that's it. There's zero room, just so barely so you can get your feet. And the second row passengers, are their knees are the same way. So it's not a very usable third row. It is truly, you're in a pinch. We're all going to die if we don't use a third row. I've got one. That's how I look at the third row in this.
It sounds like it's, I don't know if you remember the previous generation Rogue, when it came out back in, I want to say around 2014, 15 or so, for at least two or three model years at the beginning of that cycle. They did offer a similar third row in there.
Yeah.
And it was basically useless like this.
It's exactly the same. And wasn't it called the Rogue? I mean, remember, was it the Rogue XL for a while or something?
I don't think so. I think it was just the regular Rogue. It was just a third row was an option.
Because
it wasn't any longer than any other Rogue. It was the same two-row.
And that's the problem. It's like, I get, you know, it's just not, this car isn't, it's not big enough for a third row. Now, if you're just putting cargo back there and you have the seat folded down, the 4-step process, and you got it folded down and you push the second row, you know, all the way back so that it's as far back as it goes, then riding in the second row is great. It's actually really roomy. There's plenty of room. There's good headroom. There's good leg room. Two people really easily sitting back there, three adults. You can still sit back there. You'd be a little snug, like you wouldn't want to go on a road trip, but there's enough room. So if you're using it all the time as a 2-row SUV, you're totally fine. And it's a comfortable, nicely appointed. It has a really attractive interior, nice supportive front seats, very comfy. But if you're going to use that third row for anything other than like, well, wait, we messed up, we need a little bit more seating for this really short drive, you're not going to be pleased with that third row. It just doesn't, it's not realistic. But driving it, it's fine to drive. It has a good amount of power. Like I said, the only time is if you really are aggressive on the gas, you get a little bit of whine, you can hear it, it doesn't sound great. But in terms of having enough power to get moving, it gets out of its own way, it handles well. I just drove it home from a movie in pouring rain. I was almost late for the podcast. Guys, John Wick is longer than you think it is. So I was late getting to the podcast, but it's really torrential rains. It handled really well. So it's a little super all-wheel control, did its thing and made it. It felt very confident, even though the roads are very, very wet. So, I mean, in terms of a driving experience, the interior look, style, and comfort, I give it all a great score on that, except that third row. That third row, no, that's not really usable.
Do you know, is that third row an option or is it standard equipment on the plug-in?
You know what? That's a good question. Plug-in. I don't know if it's a standard or an option. I honestly don't know, Sam. I didn't check that out to see whether it was standard. I somehow thought it was a standard.
It looks like it. I'm just going through the build and price on the Mitsubishi website.
I had it in my head that it was a standard feature that you just got the third row. It wasn't like you could ditch it and give yours. Because if you did ditch it, you're going to have your cargo area would get. I mean, because it all it folds down. I mean, it's nice that it folds down. And once it's folded down, it is like nice little compact. It makes me think of the like the Stow and Go seats that you have in the Pacifica, where they just kind of, once they're folded down, you don't even realize there's a seat there. They create this nice level floor. So it's the same thing, except the Pacifica seats are way easier to stow. But it's the same idea. Once you fold those down, it's not like you have bumps and ridges from the seats. It's just a nice low, like flat, perfectly flat cargo floor. And you don't have to worry about anything getting, you know, lost on the sides or whatever. But yeah, it's super small, people. And when people say, yo, use for the kids, I don't know how you would get back there to put your kids into that seat.
Like, and the thing
to
is,
buckle them in.
You know, for small kids that are going to fit in there, they should probably be at least in a booster seat anyway,
right?
If not a child seat, in which case, you know, then, you know, they're going to be sticking out a little bit more anyway, and right. trying to get in there, reach in there to strap them in and everything. Yeah. It sounds like the best thing to do if you get an Outlander plug-in hybrid is just fold down those back seats mm-hmm. and then forget they ever existed.
Pretty much. Pretty much. Unless I said like zombie apocalypse, I need that second row to save a third row to save a couple people. Spend 20 minutes figuring out how it works, flip it up and save two people.
On the other hand, you know, you could just, you know, if you're in a zombie apocalypse.
Yes.
That may be one time when it might be okay to like just shove two or three people in the cargo area.
I don't know. Safety first. I mean,
yeah, but you want to save that 20 minutes.
That's
true. You're probably going to gain more from that extra 20 minutes you have to get away from the zombies.
That's true. Someone could get bitten and die in those 20 minutes. So maybe the smarter thing is just...
I would normally never, ever recommend that. But in that one scenario of a zombie apocalypse,
you would say
might be the time.
Jump in the, you know what? You might be right. If there's a zombie apocalypse, forget it. Just jump in the cargo area and go.
As many people as you can squeeze in there and then just hit the road.
And just go.
Yeah.
You're out. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, a 20-minute head start on the zombies. That's could be worth a lot.
Because they always say they shamble, but then you watch some zombies are really fast, depending on your zombie lore.
Yes. It depends entirely on the zombies. I mean,
right?
If you got fast zombies, you know, like
trouble.
World War Z, you want that 20 minutes. You
so
don't
like
want to be
Walking Dead zombies, like the ones when I watched Walking Dead when it was new. So I don't know if they changed, but the Walking Dead zombies that truly shamble, you might be able to get the seats up. World War Z zombies, you're dead.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk. So, and pricing, I figure we should talk pricing while we're talking zombies. So this is as equipped. This one is $50,880. So it's not outrageous, but it's not inexpensive either. And it does have, like, this is the everything version. You know what I mean? You've got the leather seats. You've got, there's like heated front row seats, a heated steering wheel. You've got tri-zone climate control. You know, you have like a 12.3-inch, I think, digital instrument cluster, nice, I think it's 9-inch infotainment touchscreen. So you wireless charging, you get all the bells and whistles for that. But it is, you know, I think when you get most plug-in hybrids, and especially if you get to the top, you do start hitting that $50,000 point. That's not really that unusual.
Yeah. And, you know, when I drove the standard gas engined Outlander,
yeah,
I quite liked it. You know, I mean, it's the same platform that's under the Rogue. It's the same wheelbase, same length and everything.
Yep.
And it drives really well.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it's not the plug-in hybrid is not listed on fueleconomy.gov yet.
Really? And it's funny because I literally got a Monroney that's half a Monroney that doesn't have the fuel economy part.
Yeah. Well, that may be why you only got half.
Maybe that's why. Maybe the other half doesn't exist for some reason.
but according to the press release, the overview press release from last September when they launched it, it has a 20 kilowatt hour battery pack, which is a pretty good sized battery pack for a plug-in hybrid like this. That gives 38 miles of electric driving range and gets 64 miles per gallon equivalent combined in combined plug-in plus gas operation or plug-in plus hybrid operation.
That's good. So, yeah. Oh, and you know what? Something else worth mentioning on this. So a lot of I'm going to forget the names of all the different plugs, but I feel like you're going to know the J's all of that. Okay. So the standard plug-in hybrids most of them can't accommodate DC fast charging. They don't have the right kind of connector. Mm-hmm. This does. This accommodates DC fast charging, sort of. Like, but it's still better than because if you go to one and you can't, like if you have a plug-in hybrid and someone's using the one outlet that's J, there's a name for it.
There's J1772.
Is that the one I'm thinking of?
That's the standard. That's the North American standard.
So if it doesn't, if you have like the average plug-in hybrid, like my Wrangler, you can't plug it in unless that like a lot of them, there's four different, you know, chargers. Only one of them has the plug that will work with this. If you have the fast charging on the other, you can't use the fast charging plug. You're literally out of luck. This one, you're not out of luck.
Yeah, this is the Outlander is the only plug-in hybrid in the US market that has support for DC fast charging.
Yeah.
And they, for some reason, they opted to go with the CHAdeMO connector on there.
Yeah.
Instead of using a CCS connector, the combined charging standard.
Right.
And so you actually have two outlets on there. Mm-hmm. One is the J1772, which is just it's the top part of the CCS connector.
Right.
For the AC charging. And then for DC charging, it's got the CHAdeMO connector. So it's the same setup that was that's on the Leaf.
Yes.
But Nissan, which is the only other company besides Mitsubishi that has ever used CHAdeMO in North America.
Is it really? They're the only ones?
And it's a Japanese, it's a Japanese standard.
I associated it with the Leaf, but I never made the connection that literally they're the only ones to do it. Okay.
Yeah. And so even, you know, for the Aria, Nissan has gone away from CHAdeMO. For the Aria, they're doing whatever the local standard is in whichever market the vehicle is being sold in.
Which
so if you buy
sense.
An Aria, yeah, if you buy an Aria in Japan, you get a CHAdeMO connector. If you buy an Aria in Europe, you get a CCS Type 2, which is their variant. And in North America, you get the CCS Type 1, which is what everybody else uses.
Yeah.
But for some reason, Mitsubishi decided to stick with CHAdeMO on this one, which, CHAdeMO, has some advantages, but, it's limited to 50 kilowatts. But for a 20 kilowatt hour battery pack,
I feel like it's not really so much that you're going to be like, you're looking like, oh, I got to charge fast and get on your way. Because if you want to get on your way, just fill it with gas. You know what I mean? It has a gas tank. I just think it's nice that if you want to, get a little extra juice, your chances of being able to find a charger to do it are greater than they are in a typical plug-in hybrid.
Yeah. And, if you're on a family road trip and, you're stopping to do a lunch break anyway, and there happens to be a CHAdeMO connector there.
Exactly. Yeah,
you might as well, plug it in.
Right.
Get another 38 miles of electric range before you start running on gas again. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think most people are probably not ever going to use that CHAdeMO connector. They're just going to
plug it home. But they could, Sam.
They could. They absolutely could. And that's a good thing.
It's there.
Yes.
When that whole zombie apocalypse thing happens and you need every bit of juice you can get, you'll be glad you could plug into the CHAdeMO for an extra 30 miles of electric range.
Except, again, we get back to the timing there. Do you really want to be sitting around for 20 minutes or half an hour charging that battery up?
Maybe you're on a spot that is like you're in the middle of a Walmart parking lot and you can see there are no zombies nearby. Take every little bit of juice you can get. Like, okay, we're going to top it off. Like, oh, wait, there's zombies. Unplug. Woo. And they run.
Okay. Fair enough.
I have a plan.
All right. That works.
Oh, and what do you think? I know Robbie's not here, but what do you think the destination was?
I am going to say 1095.
Oh, you're really low.
Really?
Was it
like 1500, 1700?
1345.
Wow. Okay.
This is pretty pricey.
Yeah. So sounds like it's a good vehicle though. If you're looking for, a crossover, for a modest sized family, not necessarily, a humongous family, but if you got two or three kids, this could be a useful hauler to haul the kids around, do road trips, whatever.
I think exactly. I think it's, it is a solid little SUV / crossover. You get that little bit of electric range. It's great for people who are, again, I like plug-in hybrids because they give you a chance to say, what's it like living with an electric vehicle without the anxiety of, oh gosh, I only have an electric vehicle. Because people are nervous about it who've never owned one before. And how hard is it going to be to live with them? What's it like? Get used to plugging in your car, still have your backup as, gas is backup. And this isn't an outrageous price for how it's equipped. That's a reasonable price. It's comfortable to me. You got to think of it as a two-row. Don't think of it as a three-row, people. That's the only caution I have on this.
Yeah. And that 30 miles, as long as you plug it in every night, you absolutely should do. If you're going to buy a plug-in hybrid,
you need to
plug it in every night. If you don't plan to charge it daily, then just don't even bother. Just buy something else.
It's not worth it. You have to,
if you're spending a lot of extra money and carrying around several hundred pounds of battery that you're not using.
You're killing your fuel economy. Now you have a plug-in hybrid that is hurting you, not helping you, because you're just carrying gigantic batteries around, like having a dead weight in your car, and you're never taking advantage of them.
Right. But if you do plug it in, now you're getting that 38 miles, which for the vast majority of people is going to allow you to do all your driving on electricity. And it'll be like having an EV. And then when it is time for that road trip or, escaping the zombies, you just keep going. You don't have to stop every 38 miles to charge it.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm a big plug-in hybrid fan. I think it's a great happy medium for people in general. I feel like that's the step. Like, everyone kind of got just a regular hybrid and that was all that really was out there. Plug-ins were like, no, they were like, they just didn't really exist for the most part. And then all of a sudden regular hybrids, and those were new and scary. And then you drove that, you're like, hey, this is actually okay. Now, like, okay, next step, people, go for a plug-in hybrid. We'll gradually get you to EVs. Just baby steps, you'll get there.
Yep. All right. Okay. I had a double booking last week.
Okay.
So I had, first off, the Rivian R1S, and I had a launch edition, but, you know, pricing, I think the price for the launch edition is slightly higher, but, basically if you equip it, you know, essentially the same as what I had, it comes out to $99,000.
Ouch. That's expensive.
So the R1S is a little shorter than the R1T, which I drove last year. So the R1T is the pickup. The R1S is a three-row SUV. It's about about a foot shorter overall, and a little bit shorter wheelbase. But the second row, it's a three-row, and it's almost exactly the same size as the Jeep Grand Cherokee L. So the three-row version of the Grand Cherokee.
So it's pretty big. There's lots of room.
Yeah, it's a good size vehicle. Because the way they've configured the interior, because you don't have the bed back there, you can actually move the second row seat back a little bit and have more room in the second row than you do in the R1T. Because the R1T, obviously, you've got the bulkhead there, you know, for the bed. So you can't move the second row seat. The second row seat in the R1S are adjustable. So if you're only using the first two rows, you can move those second row seats back and have a ton of rear leg room. It's like, you know, riding in a Genesis G90. Without the foot ottoman. And then if you're using the third row, you can scooch the second row seats up a few inches. And I climbed into the third row of the R1S. And I was able to be comfortable back there, unlike in the Outlander. You know, I could sit reasonably comfortably back there and still have enough room in the second row that I could have also sat in the second row. So it's not like you're taking away all the second row leg room in order to have the third row.
That's
so,
what you have to do.
So it's a good usable three row vehicle. And of course, you know, it's Rivian, so it's electric. Yeah. Right now, they're still only selling the four motor version, which is the same as what you get with the R1T. So it's like 830 horsepower, I think, something like roughly like that. So it is stupidly quick. and then, as I said, I think for a lot of people, you know, this may be a more useful option than the pickup. Of course, you don't get the gear tunnel, but you don't need it either because you can fold down the third row seats. You've got lots of space for all your stuff in the back. Mm-hmm. Basically from the B pillar forward, so from the front seats forward, it's exactly the same as the R1T. So you have the same frunk, which means you also have the same issue I had with that one, which is the front fascia. Unlike on the F-150 Lightning and the upcoming Silverado and Sierra and also on the Hummer, the front fascia is fixed in place, which means you have to lift over.
That would be awkward.
It can be. It depends what you're loading in there. If you've got heavy stuff that you're going to put in there, it's going to be a little more awkward. And
how tall is the grill? In my head now I'm thinking F-150 grill. Only Robbie could reach over if it was made that way.
It's about a little less than 5 feet tall.
Okay.
So, I mean, you would be able to reach in and put stuff in there. So, I mean, it's not ridiculously high.
Okay.
Assuming, you know, that the suspension, the air suspension is set in park mode. if you put it in off-road mode, so you're up at like 15.9 inches or 15 inches.
Would I really not be able to reach in, do you think? 5'6"?
You would probably have a hard time at that point. I mean, it's going to be very awkward. Let's put it that way.
Got it. Fair enough.
You could probably get stuff over, but reaching in to grab stuff, it's going to be really awkward.
Lob it into the frunk. Whee!
Yeah. So, you know, that's an issue with both the S and the T. But aside from that, you know, the trunk, it's still a very usable space. I think it's about 11 and a half cubic feet. So a little bit smaller than what you get in the F-150, but still very, very much usable. I mean, you can put several carry-on bags in there, you know, duffel bags or all kinds of gear, you know, whatever you want in there. So lots of space to put your stuff in there. For the most part, the driving experience is pretty similar to the R1T. There, you know, in the 9 months since I drove the pickup, there have been a number of software updates and a number, you know, some pretty substantial improvements. The infotainment system has gotten more responsive. The Driver Plus ADAS system is definitely better than it was before. You know, it's still a hands-on system. It's not a hands-free system yet. It may be at some point in the future. They do actually have an infrared driver monitor camera that's in there that they can use. So if they go hands-free, they can make sure you keep your eyes on the road. That sort
does
of
it
thing.
Does it do anything right now? Is the camera, no. Is it sort of just, it's just like there, it's just, they decide there. To do it?
Yeah. Okay. And I think they've indicated that at some point they will do that. But right now it's a hands-on driver assist system. I mean, you can take your hands off for like 10 seconds or something before it starts warning
before you. Before it beeps you and it's like, hey, yeah. Pay attention. That's not what I'm doing.
Exactly. but the hands-on feature works quite well. It does a good job of tracking the lanes. One issue I had with it was, you know, for example, with Super Cruise, when I was driving the Hummer the week before, mm-hmm. When you change lanes, you tap on the turn signal to initiate a lane change, or just do a lane change manually. You steer over into the adjacent lane. And then as soon as the vehicle is centered up in the steering wheel, as long as you haven't hit the cancel button or anything like that, as soon as you get centered up back in the lane again, it will automatically resume lane centering. So you don't have to do anything else.
Right.
So once it finds the new lanes, lane markings, it will take over and allow you to take your hands off the wheel again.
Okay.
This one, if you tap the turn signal, or if you you steer without signaling your lane change, it will cancel the lane centering system, and then you have to do a double tap on the right steering column stock, which is also your shifter, in order to reinitiate the lane centering. It's a minor thing, but you know it's a little bit of an annoyance.
Yeah.
The bigger annoyance for me,
yes,
is Rivian's approach to the HMI in general, where essentially they have replicated what Tesla does, which is no buttons on the dash at all. Mm. It's all in the center touchscreen. You do have an instrument cluster display. Unlike the Model 3 or Model Y, the Model S and the X do have an instrument cluster as well. So you've got the big 14-inch center display and the instrument cluster display. And then you've got two roller wheels on the steering column or on the steering wheel and then side rockers on surrounding that. So, and those are unmarked. Because they do multiple functions. It's contextually sensitive.
I do not like that.
I don't like that either. You know,
I always find it a challenge.
Trying to remember. I mean, I think over time you would get used to, you know, depending on what mode the thing is in, what it's doing. I mean, sometimes it's going to be, you know, on the right rocker, it's going to adjust the speed for your cruise control. That other times it might be doing something else.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of an annoyance, but it's something I wish that they hadn't done, you know, that they would just have some more dedicated controls.
Yeah.
And also for the climate control, having, you know, dedicated climate controls. Now, granted, the climate controls are they're permanently displayed on the screen. So there's a strip along the bottom that's got your menu, you know, and your climate, you can adjust your temperatures and stuff there, but still you have to look at it to hit the touch targets. It's not like reaching out to twist a knob.
Yeah.
The other main annoyance I have with it is, the Alexa voice services for the voice control. It was it was very hit and miss, for me in terms of understanding what I wanted it to do. And then sometimes with the response, like using it to put in a navigation destination, you know, I would say, you know, Alexa, Sorry about that for anybody that happens to have an Alexa in the room while you're listening to this. Madam A, navigate to Michigan Stadium. Yeah, that's an example. And it would just kind of say, you know, it would seem like it was doing something, and then it wouldn't actually bring up the route. So I'm not sure if the problem is actually in the voice service part of it or somewhere else in the stack. Yeah. But it was kind of hit and miss sometimes.
Huh.
Climate control, it worked okay. If I told it to set the temperature to a specific temperature, then it would do that. If I said, you know, I'm cold, or if I said I'm cold, it would make it warmer. If I said, you know, raise or just, you know, increase the temperature, then it wouldn't work. It was just, you know, a bunch of, it was inconsistent.
I was going to say, it sounds like when it works, and when it doesn't, which exactly. makes it frustrating.
Yeah.
This inconsistency. I wonder why it's so hard to get it. Because normally things you're like, they all kind of sort of, you have a certain level of like, okay, it all functions at this 75% of what I want or 90% of what I want. This is like it was all over the place.
Yeah, it was. And then, of course, you know, Rivian, like Tesla, does not have support for Android Auto or Apple CarPlay. They have several apps built in. So they've got TuneIn, Spotify built in.
And how much does that bug you? Like, is that something you like when you don't have Apple CarPlay or Android Auto that it really bothers you? Or do you get used to whatever the car has instead?
I find it annoying in part because usually whatever substitute voice control system they have is annoying me, like Alexa was in this one. And I find myself much less annoyed by Android Assistant or Google Assistant. I like the interface better.
That's fair. I get frustrated by it too. I use Apple all the time. So Siri frustrates me far less than what they normally have as an alternative to Siri and to Android Auto. So,
and with almost, you know, almost all other vehicles now, you know, you have the choice. So drivers can pick what they want to use. If they want to use the factory system, they can do that. If they want to use the Android Auto or Apple CarPlay, they can use that. You know what? So they have the choice to do what they want. Whereas, you know, Rivian has made the choice, and if you don't like it, too bad.
Suck it up, buttercup.
Yeah. Ride quality. I felt better. You know, it's hard to say for sure without driving it back to back with the R1T I drove, but the R1T felt a little stiff. This one definitely seemed a little more comfortable to drive than the R1T did. It's still very, very quick, quicker than anybody really needs.
Cars these days quicker than what anybody has really
very
need.
True. And then the other issue is, like the R1T, the R1S is not particularly efficient, energy efficient.
Really?
I averaged 1.8 miles per kilowatt hour. It's not like it was cold, but it wasn't snowing or anything, you know, so I had heat on, but it was not wasn't any kind of particularly bad weather, other than, you know, just normal winter weather here. So it was not particularly efficient. Now, the one I had the 20-inch wheels with all-terrain tire package on there, which does degrade the range a bit. If you go with the standard wheels, I think you get about 310 miles of range, EPA estimated range. With the ones that I had, it's 289. I don't think I wasn't getting quite that good. It was a little bit less than that. It was probably closer to about 250, is what I would have gotten, which, you know, given I had the heat on, you know, it was fine. But for a vehicle with 130 kilowatt hour battery pack, you know, it's not terribly impressive.
It's not great.
Yeah.
Why do you think? Is it because of the weight? Is it one of those vehicles
that just weighs so much? It's heavy. I did drive it in conserve mode most of the time. So, you know, you've got multiple driving modes. There's off-road modes and all-terrain modes and snow and stuff. And the conserve mode actually disengages. There's a there's clutches on the rear axle to decouple the rear wheels from the rear motors so they're not dragging.
Okay.
So basically it operates as a front wheel 420 horsepower front wheel drive SUV when you put it in conserve mode.
Wow.
That's the most efficient mode. It's still not particularly efficient. One thing that is definitely better than when I drove the R1S last year is the way the regen braking works.
How so?
One of the complaints I had about the R1T was when the battery is full, and you have strong regen turned on, at that point, the battery can't really absorb any extra energy. And so, it just says, well, I'm sorry, I can't do regen right now until you've depleted the battery by at least a few percent. So what happens is, when you drive away with a full charge, and then you lift off the accelerator expecting some strong regen, you don't get any. Now it does that. And I think what they're doing is they're probably blending in some friction brakes, which is what other manufacturers do. Is if your battery's full and it can't absorb the energy, fine. Whatever, it's going to respond to whatever you're doing with the pedal and give you the amount of decel you expect.
Right.
By whichever mechanism it can, whether if it can do regen, great. If not, then it'll just use the friction brakes.
Which makes sense. Okay.
And, so it's more consistent. And so it does that now. So that's definitely a big improvement. So all in, $99,000.
Oof.
For this one. It's not an inexpensive truck. The starting price for the Adventure, the R1S Adventure, starts at $78,000. But you can't actually buy that one right now, because that's with the dual motor, and the standard battery pack. The paint color I had, El Cap Granite, was a $2,500 option.
Was it that cool? Was it worth $2,500?
No, not really. I mean, it's gray.
No, it wasn't. It was
a nice gray, but it's still gray.
Is there not extra add-on price gray?
The LA Silver. So dark El Cap Granite is a darker gray. El Cap Silver is the one color you get for free. The Glacier White is $1,750. And all the other colors, red, blue, the limestone is also $1,750. The Rivian Blue, the green, the El Cap Granite, and the yellow are all $2,500 options.
Wow.
The standard battery pack is not available yet. It will be supposedly sometime later this year, along with the dual motor configuration. So right now you can only get the quad motor, which is $8,000, and the large pack, which is $6,000 extra, and then assorted other options.
That's a lot.
But all in, this one was about $99,000.
That's a lot of money.
It is.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. The other car that I had was the 2023 Genesis G90 3.5T e-supercharger all-wheel drive, which I think is even longer than the name of
my car. You beat it.
Yeah. So the G90 is all new for 2023 model year. Great looking car. I mean, if you're looking for a big luxury sedan, this is a I think, one of the best looking ones out there.
It's a beautiful car. It really is. Yeah.
They all come with there's no longer a V8 option available in the G90. It's a 3.5 liter twin turbo V6 now. But there's also an option to add the E supercharger on there. So, every G90's got a twin turbo V6. The E supercharger, mm-hmm. Is an electric supercharger. So basically they have a 48 volt, mild hybrid system on here. And the E supercharger is basically half of a turbocharger. So a turbocharger consists of, two centrifugal wheels on there. There's a turbine, and there's a shaft. And on the other end of that shaft is a compressor, and your exhaust gases flow through the turbine side, spin that up when you're driving. And that spins the compressor, which forces more air into the engine and makes more power. What they've done, what this E supercharger is they eliminate the turbine side of that, replace it with a little electric motor.
Okay.
So it spins up the compressor. Because the problem with turbochargers is you have to get enough exhaust gas flow to spin the thing up to generate boost. So you get what's known as turbo lag.
Turbo lag.
The E supercharger, because it's electric, it can spin up instantaneously on demand. So as you press the accelerator pedal, it's starting to crank that thing up and generating boost before the turbos can spin up and generate boost. And it's a smaller compressor, so it's got really low inertia, so it can spin up really fast. Mm-hmm. So it's a little more responsive. It's not much. You don't get much.
Did you
more
know?
Power
could you notice a big difference? Like
I haven't driven the regular one to know a difference, but what I can say is that it felt very responsive.
Okay.
It felt like a bigger engine. So with the E supercharger version, it's 409 horsepower, 405 foot-pounds of torque. The regular twin turbo is, I think, 389. You know, so it's like 20 horsepower. So it's not a huge amount of extra power, but the difference is in the responsiveness. Right. You know, and if you Jared from Genesis sent me some material on it, and you see the torque curve and how it just gets up basically to max almost instantly,
like right away. Yeah.
Yeah. So it definitely does feel more responsive than a normal twin turbo V6 would. Besides that, this is just a lovely car to spend time in. Yeah. Beautiful materials, lovely leather. And if you are someone who prefers to be driven rather than to do the driving, I mean, I like to drive.
Same.
I even for a large car, I like driving this thing. Mm-hmm. But if you are somebody who prefers to spend time in the backseat being driven, then this is a great car to do that in. And particularly if you're on the passenger side, because what you can do is from the passenger seat, there's controls on the side of the center console, where you can recline your seat, bring up the ottoman. You can also slide the front passenger seat forward, all the way forward, and tilt the seat back forward, so you can, you know, get into a
lounge in the back.
Lounge back
you.
There, yeah. And you know, if that's your thing, you know, this is a great place to do it. It's a lovely car to do that in. You know, very comfortable, but also very, you know, it doesn't feel soft or you know, floppy or anything as you're driving down you know, curvy roads. You know, it feels very responsive. It is typical of what we've come to expect from Genesis over the last 7 or 8 years, you know. Yeah. Along with the rest of the Hyundai Motor Group, just really well executed across the board. Like I said, first class materials. The leather is nice and soft and plush. But you know, the front seats, the driver's seat, you know, get still nice and supportive. You know, so it'll hold you in place while you're going through those curvy back roads.
Mm-hmm.
Napa, you know, the Napa leather, heated everything, massaging seats,
everything. That's my kind of everything. I just want it to glow like the inside of a toaster. That's what I want.
Yeah. And the ambient lighting, you know, when it's dark, you know, you get this purple ambient lighting that looks really pleasant in there.
Yeah.
Nice big, 12.3 inch HD screen, in there. It's touch, but there's also a center controller. So, you know, both of us could enjoy our time in there. And it's got support for wireless Android Auto and CarPlay. There's a heads-up display, active noise control. It's got Genesis Digital Key 2, and there's a fingerprint sensor on the it doesn't have the camera for facial recognition like the G60 does or GV60 does, but it does have fingerprint sensor on the dash. So you can, once you program that, you can use that, you know, to wake up the car and start it.
Did you try the fingerprint thing?
I didn't on this one. I'd done it previously on the GV60 and it worked fine. I didn't bother taking the time to do it on this one. But you know, you got wireless chargers for your mobile devices, carpeted floor mats, all the goodies,
all the stuff that you would expect,
all the stuff you would expect at this price point, which, is, also about what the Rivian went for, which is $100,370.
Do you think it's worth $100,370?
You know, if I was shopping in this price segment against, you know, say an Audi A8, BMW 7 Series, Mercedes S-Class, yeah, I would say so.
Yeah? Okay.
You know, as everything from Hyundai Motor Group tends to be, you know, for whatever segment it's in, it's not cheap, but I think it's a good value for the type of car that it is.
Well, especially for Genesis, because Genesis is a luxury brand. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's a Hyundai. It is the luxury branch of the brand. So I think I find Genesis vehicles to be absolutely beautiful inside. They're comfortable. They're so quiet. They have that, you know, that sort of ensconces you, like keeps the outside world outside so that you just feel like you're escaping from everything, whether you're driving or lounging in the back. I tend to really like their vehicles. And I think, like you said, although this is an expensive car, it's not cheap. If you're buying a luxury car, it competes with the other guys, no problem.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You want to take a stab at the freight?
I'm terrible at this, but I win no matter what, unless I go over. I don't know. Are they really expensive or just $11.95?
Ooh, you went over. $10.95.
It's so easy. He's not even here, and I still lose.
We were just talking about value.
And I know. Well, I was this stupid third. I'm like, well, this one was $13.95, and it's a luxury vehicle, so I'll make it a little less. Should have gone lower.
Yes.
Dang it. Shaking my fist at the sky.
And the G90 3.5T supercharger all-wheel drive is EPA rated at 17 city, 24 highway, 20 combined. I got about 18, but you know, again, it was cold. So wintertime, you know, you're generally going to get a little bit less. I think, you know, if I was driving in the summertime, it would probably be closer to 20.
Yeah, you do a little better.
Yep. All right. Let's see, what else do we have? So in addition to the Outlander, you went to some place to drive something last week.
I did. I drove. Let's see. Does it say I'm talking about?
Actually, it was the week before.
I was going to say it's not last week. Don't confuse me, Sam.
A couple weeks ago.
I went to Asheville, North Carolina, where it was like really beautiful, but really cold. I don't know why it was cold and rainy. That's not what I expect down there. But it was terrible weather, but a beautiful drive anyway in the Dodge Hornet, which is not like the old Hornet. And, you know, oh, you tarnished the name of Hornet forever. Just cool your jets, all you classic car people. Sometimes
cars come back. Do you remember the last car that was named a Hornet?
I've been told 1,000 times, like, it's come, the Hornet was originally this, but I get these very, like.
the last Hornet we had was the AMC Hornet.
Oh, was that it?
Yeah, from the 19.
They're listing some other Hornet.
Early 80s, it went out of
production. Other Hornet. Some other guy was listing some other Hornet. Maybe it was an older Hornet.
I don't know.
But so yeah, the phrase I want to use, I'm not going to use. Everyone is very discreet.
I don't think they had anything to worry about as far as tarnishing the name of the AMC Hornet.
Wait, was there a Hudson Hornet?
Oh yeah, but that was back in the 1950s. Yeah.
Okay. So the guy at Twitter, I'm pointing to the phone, is yelling at me. The Hudson Hornet is a full-size automobile that was manufactured by Hudson Motor Car of Detroit from 1951 to 1954. Thanks.
Let me be more specific. It was Hudson Motor Car of Ypsilanti. They were built right here in the town where I live.
I want to well actually, it's really tempting, but I won't.
But they, you know, Hudson went out of business in like 1958, I think, or 59.
But how dare they use the name? It's the weirdest thing. People are very upset about the fact that it's called a Hornet, and people are very upset about the fact that it's like, it's not a muscle car. It's not a straight up muscle car from Dodge, but that's not what they were building. They wanted to build a little sporty crossover that still kind of looks, it has, I mean, it looks like a crossover, but you can see the Dodge in it. You know, if you look at the hood and stuff, you can see the Dodge styling in it. I don't think it's this horrific departure from the brand, given that it's a very different car compared to the Charger or the Challenger.
I mean, you look at it and it looks like a 5/8 scale Durango.
Yeah. So it fits. Like, it fits in there. You're like, I can see how this fits within the brand's design aesthetic. It works. Driving it, you have two engine options. There's a gas engine and there is also a plug-in hybrid. And we did most of the time that we were driving, we were in the gas powered engine, which is, I'm losing everything here. This is what happens when you rush to a podcast from a movie. So the gas powertrain is nice and responsive. It's fine. It does really well. It handled really well. Like, I was surprised. I don't know why I didn't have great hopes for it. I think it's for handling only because, like, the Charger doesn't like corners. Challenger does not like corners. They want to go in a straight line. You put them in a twisty and they're like, no, please don't. Like, there's very straight line cars. So I don't know what I expected from this. But it delivered. Like, I thought it handled really beautiful. I thought it handled really nicely. We had these very twisty, turny roads that we went on outside of Asheville. You know, the kind that if you have a nice car to drive, are fun to drive. If you have a not nice car, they're gonna be a chore to go back and forth like that. I found it very fun to drive. We also did the plug-in hybrid. The plug-in hybrid is funner. It has a good bit more horsepower. It's got a little bit more oomph to it. It's got better hand. It just altogether felt more hunkered down. I think the way the little battery changes how it feels a little bit. You can feel a little bit of difference to it. If I was going to buy this, I would go for the hybrid. It's not just because I'm a plug-in hybrid fan. I liked how this one drove better. Inside, it's comfortable. It looks very Dodge. It still has Dodge styling. Nothing is like finessed and fine and delicate. It's sort of got that bolder, bigger, larger kind of, you know, Brotherhood of Muscle kind of vibe happening. I did like, they called it a track package, either track pack or track package, that added some extra pop to how it looked inside, including seats that, like, it has this suede, that suede Alcantara seat, but it had little perforations in it. And the inside of the perforations was red. So you look inside and you have like black fuzzy seats and there's little red dots peeking through. So it looked really neat. I thought that was kind of neat. It gave it a little bit of extra sort of panache. And I think the Hornet logo is really cute. The little Hornet on the side, it's like an angry little Hornet. I feel like now it's like a law. If you're going to build a Dodge, you have to have some kind of really cool little Fender badge. Like after they did the Hellcats and stuff.
Hellcat, you got Hornet. Next year you got Banshee coming.
Right. Like if they tried to do that, like God would strike it down. No, you have offended me. And like, if they don't put that little funky little badge of some kind there, that's like a signature thing for them now. So I liked the Hornet. People were hating on it. Like, really hating on the styling and the fact that it wasn't going to be, and they were hating on the fact that the Alfa Romeo Tonale is pretty much theoretically the same.
Yeah, it's the same. They designed the Tonale and Dodge said, hey, we like that.
Yeah.
We want one too. And so they put a Durango fascia on it and instantly created the Hornet.
So people are mad because they're saying it's not a Dodge. It's a Tonale. It's an Alfa Romeo. The look of the two is different. Like the Dodge looks like a Dodge. The Alfa looks like an Alfa. You can see that there's different styling to it. I read, although I don't know because I've not driven one, that things are tuned a little bit differently in terms of the driving dynamics. So you should feel a little bit of a difference between the two. I don't know how much, and I don't know if the difference is going to make the Dodge feel better or the Alfa feel better in the end, or if it's really going to depend on how you like to drive. But, you know, a lot of companies have vehicles that are badged differently for different brands within their lineup, and they just tune things a little differently. It's not outrageous. It's not some craziness. Like, can you believe? Yeah, I can believe. I can totally believe they did this. Totally believe it. So I like the Hornet. And they said, the one thing though, they said in the presentation Someone had said that they felt that this was significantly increased. You know, they talk about the kind of customers, they talk about who's going to drive our car. Is it going to be the same customer? Are we going to have conquests like people who may have driven been driving a Ford and suddenly they come over to the Dodge brand? You want those conquest customers, right? What they think they're going to get more of, a lot more of, are women, because I guess it leans heavily towards men.
Really?
And they think a lot. Yeah, I know, it's shocking, right? Yeah.
More men than women buy Hellcats?
It's totally counterintuitive, Sam. I don't know, but that's what they say, so I believe them. Okay. So they say this should like bring in new customers because they think that we'll bring in more women to the brand, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, you know, expand their appeal to new people. So it could change the buyer. But I still think the person who likes Dodge, who likes the way that sort of Dodge feel, that sort of the styling, the feel, the look of Dodge, and wants to stay with that brand, but can't do that doesn't want the Durango because it's really, really big. And, you know, it's not going to work for a family necessarily have a Charger or a Challenger. This is a great option. This is a really solid option. I think they did a good job with it. I don't know. The Dodge fanboy anger toward it was so extreme. I don't know how that's going to play out, but I did like this overall.
You know, I think for those people that, you know, are fans of Dodge muscle cars, you know, look, nobody's forcing you to buy this.
Right.
Just it's like buy your Challenger or your Charger.
Exactly.
You know? At least while you can, because, I mean, they're going away at the end of the year. But, you know, you still got time. Buy one of those. And even when those go away, there's going to be electric Dodges that are even faster.
Other things. I've never understood when people get so mad about a car, and it doesn't always happen. Like, you know, you'll drive cars like, oh, I don't like an electric, I don't like hybrids, I don't like whatever. But this was like, it was like, how dare you, good sir, put the Dodge label on this car? I'm like, you guys, I'll calm down. You don't have to buy it. Yeah. It's if you hate the idea of a crossover with a Dodge badge on it so badly, then don't buy it. Go buy another Charger or Challenger. But there's lots of people who like, there's a reason they built this. Crossovers are hot. Everybody wants a crossover. Let the majority of people who aren't freaked out by crossovers have a Dodge version if they want it.
So how much range does the plug-in hybrid have, electric range?
I'm not going to lie. I don't know offhand. Hold on a second. I can look it up. Okay. I felt like it was a reasonable amount of range. Let's see. I'm looking in the...
I mean, when I've talked to them before about the Tenali, you know, they hadn't done the certification yet, but, you know, they were hinting that it would be somewhere around 30 miles.
I feel like it was in that range. I don't remember it. Oh, here we go. I got it. It offers, this is saying more than 30 miles. So maybe they don't have an exact number. This is what was in the media kit that they provided. So more than 30 miles of all electric range. So they're probably going to come in with like 31 or something like that. They say more than 30. They're not going to come in with 38, you know?
Yeah.
So more than 30 miles. And it really moves. I mean, it's pretty speedy. It's got a zero. I can give you some figures. It's got a 0 to 60 of 5.6 seconds
for the plug-in.
Okay. It has a sport mode. There's three drive modes. Like there's a hybrid and electric and an e-save. So you have that ability to play with like
same as you have
on the Jeeps. And it's got a little sport mode. So you can put it in sport mode if you want a little sportiness, more sporty handling to it. Sporty. I like sportiness. So I'm going to do that from now on. And it has 288 horsepower and 383 pound feet of torque. So the thing on that is to look at the 288 horsepower is a decent amount of horsepower. 383 pound feet of torque is a lot of torque for this little thing. It's not a big.
And that's 88 more than the 2 liter turbo.
Exactly. So there is a jump. There is a jump in there that makes this like you do feel the difference. Sometimes you don't feel, depending on how cars are tuned, you don't feel that performance difference. You're like, I don't even know. This one has 5 more horsepower, 10 more pound feet of torque, whatever. This one, you feel the difference. You definitely feel it. So that's why I'm a fan of it. Because it's 280, those numbers, which are 288 horsepower, 383 pound feet versus 268 horsepower and 295 pound feet. So the horsepower doesn't go up much, but that torque, yeah, baby, that makes a difference.
So looking at the Dodge website, the Hornet GT with the 2 liter turbo starts at $29,995. Mm-hmm. They don't have the plug-in listed on here yet. I think that they're not quite ready. I think it's not quite available yet. Did they give any indication of what the pricing is going to be on the plug-in hybrid?
I don't, you know what? I'm looking at this kit that I have and I don't recall there being pricing listed for this one. It may have been, and I may have misplaced it. I'm sorry, guys. I'm super unprepared today. So,
yeah, well, it's possible they may not have announced it yet.
Yeah.
And for 30 grand for the base Hornet with that 2-liter turbo and all wheel drive is actually a pretty good price, you know, compared to, you know, what's out there in the competition.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad place to start.
It's not a bad place to start. It's priced like within the realm of that kind of car. The pricing is affordable, but Dodge, you know, the only time really when Dodges get crazy expensive is when you're getting crazy cars.
Yeah.
You're buying yourself a Hellcat. You want to not buy a Hellcat version of the Challenger or Charger. You can get a really reasonably priced one. You want to buy yourself a Hellcat, you better be prepared to plunk down some money. So it's only the really crazy performance versions of their stuff that commands one of those prices. You're like, this is like luxury car pricing to get into some of this stuff, because it's not the luxury you're paying for. You're paying for all the power, you know?
Yeah. All right. Let's jump to another crossover that was announced this week that we actually won't be able to buy here, unfortunately.
Which is terrible. Why?
It's the Ford Explorer EV. This is not the Explorer that you're used to if you live in North America. This is a completely different vehicle. This is Ford of Europe's first purpose-built EV. It's the first of two models that they're going to launch this year that are based on the VW MEB platform. So under the skin, this is basically the same as an ID4 or an ID3, but it has completely different styling. This is a small crossover. I was talking to Ford the other day. It's actually a little bit smaller than the Escape, but it's bigger than the EcoSport, which has now been discontinued. So it's not like it's crazy small. It's actually quite a bit larger than the Jeep Avenger, which is also Europe only, mm-hmm. Which we're not going to get. Hopefully, it would be nice if Ford, you know, would see their way to offering something like this Explorer EV in North America, but I don't think they will.
Because they hate us, Sam, they hate us.
Yeah. Well, it's also, you know, that it's using the VW platform, and yeah. You know, they've said that, you know, that's not something they're going to offer here in North America. It's only for Europe. So this is built, you know, at Ford's plant in Cologne, Germany. But it's a pretty slick looking little vehicle.
It does look good. This image on this, I like how this looks a lot. Okay. So one of the things I feel like automakers are trying to figure out is how to make that without a grill, how to make that front look.
Yeah.
Like just because when it's just like thwap, they put a piece of metal there, sometimes it looks kind of weird. I really like how they broke that up.
Yeah. No, I think they did a really nice job on this. You know, when you look at it in a profile, you know, the front end is pretty short. It's a different kind of profile than you get with the ID4.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's short front overhang. Fairly short hood, and you know, like the VWs, there's no front trunk because they've packaged a bunch of stuff up in the front there to open up the interior space. But you know, the interior, you know, looks like it's pretty room, going to be reasonably roomy for the size of vehicle. Like I said, a little bit shorter, a few inches shorter than the Escape, and it's got this 15-inch center touchscreen, which is actually movable. So you can have it down lower and at more of an angle, or you can press a button and have it slide up and be more vertical and up a little bit higher if you like.
I think that's really cool, because one of the things with those really large, like the one that's upright, when you look at, sometimes you feel like the big long screens like that just kind of, they do sort of kind of, they're not really in your way, but they sort of are. Like they're almost too high and too big. So to be able to be like, ooh, let's tuck that puppy down a little bit, I think that's kind of neat.
And, you know, it also, when it's down, it hides a little storage area behind it. So you can open it, put it up, you know, to put some stuff in there that you want to keep out of sight, and then put the screen back down. And, you know, so when you're parked, you know, things aren't visible to
your super secret storage area.
Yeah. That out of sight, out of mind is always a good thing.
Right.
When you're talking about opportunistic miscreants on
someone
the street.
Could still break in and smash your screen and steal your stuff, but let's not let them know that there's anything there to begin with. Let's try to increase our odds.
If they're walking down the street and they see a car that's got stuff sitting in the console, and they see another car that's got nothing there that's visible, they're gonna go for the one that they can see, because they know there's something there that might be of value to them.
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, this is going to have a range of about 250 miles or so, and goes on sale later this year in Europe.
I wish we would get that. I think that would do well here. Do you think it would do well if we got it?
I think so. Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, if Ford could offer this, you know, at a price point in the low, and keep in mind, this is similar in size to a Hyundai Kona.
Mm-hmm.
So if they could offer this for, you know, low 30s, like somewhere between $30,000 and $35,000 starting price.
Yeah.
I think these things could sell like hotcakes.
Oh, it sell like crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they can't call it, but then it couldn't be the Explorer here because it would be.
They could badge it as something else.
They got to badge it or Explorer. What do they do? Explorer Sport. I don't know. Something smaller, right?
Wouldn't be the first time.
Like the sport thing.
Yeah. You got Bronco and Bronco Sport.
Right. Let's make it the Explorer Sport and make it tiny little Kona style thing. Yeah.
I mean, the last Explorer Sport was a pickup truck, but you know, whatever.
Shh, shh, details. You're like, you're on your Dodge Hornet thing now.
Okay. So the other MEB based EV that Ford is going to be launching is now rumored to be called the Capri, which is a name that, you know, was a long running name for Ford of Europe. They sold them here for quite a long time as well in the 1970s and 1980s. And then they also brought the name back as a not very good Mazda based Mercury convertible in the late 80s and early 90s.
Yeah,
we won't get into that one.
We'll just skip that one. Yeah.
But what do you think about bringing back the Capri name for an EV?
Well, I mean, I think it's kind of fun to bring back names, but I think you should bring back names that people liked.
People didn't like the Capri name?
Well, I don't know. Did people really like, was it beloved, Sam? Was it, did people's hearts go like, I love my Capri?
There were some people that did.
Okay. Very,
but you know, five. Richard Truitt is weird. So what can I say?
So like, I don't know. I'm fine with them bringing back names. I really don't have a problem with back names. I don't know this one. Okay. Can I just tell you why it's not my favorite name? You're going to laugh at me and think I'm stupid. All I can think of is Capri Sun. The little drink you stick the little.
That's fair enough.
I see that. And in my head, I have images of like Capri Sun commercials.
Okay.
So I'm like, I don't want to drive a pouch full of juice. That's not what I like. I want a car name.
This rendering they have on AutoCar, you know, actually looks, you know, it's got kind of a retro shape to it. It looks like the old Capri from the 1970s.
Yeah.
Which is, I think is pretty, if they do it like this, if they actually build it as a coupe like this, I think that would be pretty cool.
Actually. Yeah. The little rendering they came up with here is actually kind of nifty looking. That actually looks pretty good.
Yeah.
Does not look like a juice pouch.
Okay. next up, the Kia EV5, which is one that we hadn't heard anything about until this past week. Kia released this as a concept in China or in Korea. Or was it in China? Did they show it in China?
It took place in China.
Yeah. No, China.
Yep, it was China.
Yep.
They had an EV day. So yes, it was in China.
Yeah. So this, I like this. I mean, this basically looks like a shorter version of the EV9. Mm-hmm. So we talked about the EV9 last week. You know, this has a lot of the same design language as the EV9. Yes. But it's a smaller two row, about the size of the Sportage. What do you think?
I love it. And I think it totally fits with what they did for EV9. It's like, okay, how are we going to continue to move the brand? Oh my gosh, the EV5. And it's like this perfect cousin to it. I think it looks great. And I think they need, you know, to have another electric, to have it be a two row. The styling on this is good. And I like the headlights. They still have those funky, they remember the star map headlights they were talking about on the EV9, or I guess it's the LED lighting on the side there. The little thing, they're like an angle and angle and angle. It looks good. They kept that little design language for the lights, which I'm a big fan of for whatever reason. Yeah. I have a thing for lights.
No, I think this thing is really cool. And hopefully this is something we'll see here in North America in the next couple of years.
Did they imply it was just going to not be us? No, it's going to be for us too, right?
They didn't. I don't think they really said. I think, you know, we might hear more, but we'll certainly have an opportunity to ask about it when we're in New York for the auto show, because okay. they're going to be doing the North American unveiling of the EV9 at the auto show. So right. We can certainly ask about this one.
We can corner someone and ask them, hey, great EV9. By the way,
James, are you going to bring the EV5 to North America?
Yeah, ask it in front of a whole crowd so he can't just like sidestep you. Put him on the spot.
All right. And then finally, sticking with the Hyundai Motor Group for a minute, Hyundai is committing to buttons. Yay!
Go Hyundai. Go Hyundai! Woohoo! Thank you, Hyundai.
Show Rivian how it should be done.
Oh, look at that. Look at all. And it's not okay. So it's not like buttons. Like, what was the car I hated that had a million buttons? There was a Buick. The Buick Cascada. Was that it? That had like,
oh, yes.
It looked like a cell phone, like an old school phone. There was no, not buttons like that. This, all the things you need, the buttons you want to turn on your AC, to adjust the temperature. That picture is beautiful. That is that's beautiful. I love it. I wanted that on every car. You can rearrange things a little. You can make your buttons different shapes. That's fine. But give us buttons, people.
Yeah, at least for the stuff we use all the time. You know, the stuff we don't use very frequently, fine, put those in the touchscreen interface. But
yeah,
the stuff we use all the time, give us physical controls.
I think there's a point where the like things worked the way they worked because they worked well.
Yes.
You know, and it's like you can make this better. We can make this all super high tech. All you just slide things around and touch screens and touchpad can, you know, like the touchpad control. Remember the touchpads like in the Lexus and everything's touch. Like, this does not work when you're driving. Like, does not work. Works at my desk with a mouse. Does not work driving. Not having buttons, again, works on things where I don't have to focus on driving a car at the same time. Otherwise, give me buttons so I can just bash a button. I don't have to look away. I can feel. Third button over is what I'm looking for. 1, 2, 3, ping. There it is.
And then finally, the other day, I went down to Memphis, and Ford took us out to Stanton, Tennessee, which is northeast of Memphis, where they are in the process of building a new factory, their first greenfield assembly plant since 1969, when they opened up their Kansas City plant where they built the Transit. They built other new plants, but you know, on existing sites, like the current Rouge truck plant is, you know, was built on the site of the Rouge factory. Mm-hmm. But this is their first all new assembly plant on an all new site. And next door to it is a battery plant. So this is where they're going to be building what they're referring to as Project T3. So this is their next generation electric truck.
Okay. I'm all in with the electric truck, but I'm telling you as a nerd, when I saw T3, do you know what I immediately thought of?
No.
The Terminator T3. Oh. That was the Terminator movie. I'm like, so you're literally building the Terminator. That's all I can see when I see T3. And I'm betting that there's more than one sci-fi nerd geek out there was like, what? They called it T3?
Well, this is only an internal code name. That's not actually what they're going to call it.
I don't know that that makes it better. Our code name, wink, wink, we're not building anything that's going to take over the world. Sure, you aren't, Ford.
Well, T3 stands for trust the truck. So maybe that's even worse.
I think you're just digging the hole deeper. Trust the truck. The truck is your friend as it becomes part of the evil empire that overtakes the world and kills us all, along with the zombies.
So, you know, I had a chance to chat with Jim Farley and with Lisa Drake a little bit about this vehicle and the factory. And they gave us a tour around the site. The battery factory and the assembly plant are each going to be about 3 million square feet. And then, you know, they've got a 3,600 acre site where they're going to have suppliers coming in, setting up shop on the site as well, doing all kinds of interesting stuff. They have their own on-site utility plant. They're going to be doing geothermal power. They're not going to be bringing in any fresh water for use in the production processes. It's all captured rainwater and recycled water, all carbon-free power. So they're getting hydroelectric power from the Tennessee Valley Authority. So they're trying to keep the whole thing as green as possible. The truck itself, they're not telling us a whole lot about it right now. Lisa Drake did confirm. Lisa is the vice president of electric vehicle industrialization. So she's basically in charge of building EVs at Ford. She did confirm that this truck is going to be part of the F-Series family. So it's not going to be like a separate line, like Ranger or Maverick. It's going to be part of the F-Series family.
So it's another, wait, but they have the Lightning. So how does that work?
keep in mind, you know, this doesn't go into production until 2025.
Oh, so it's
The current generation F-Series launched at the end of 2020. They're usually on like a four or five year product cycle. So there's probably going to be a new F-Series coming out in 2025, roughly that time frame. Now, what happened, you know, the Lightning didn't launch until 2022. What's probably going to happen is that they're probably going to launch a new regular gas F-150 around 2025.
Yeah.
Build that at the Rouge and I forget the other plant where they build it now. I think Kansas City. Yeah, Kansas City, maybe, or somewhere. Anyway, they're gonna build those there. I think it sounds like they're going to continue because they did not say that this new truck is going to be a direct replacement or an immediate replacement for the Lightning. I think they're going to continue building the Lightning as it is today, probably at least through 2026, you know, maybe call it Lightning Classic or something, you know.
That would be good. Yeah, I can see that.
And so it's going to overlap for at least some period of time with the new truck, because, you know, you're talking about launching an all new vehicle on a new platform in a new plant, new assembly plant, new battery plant. They're saying the way they're designing this truck, it's designed unlike the Lightning, which is a derivative of the standard F-150. This is designed from the ground up as an electric truck. So it's an all new platform, all new electrical and electronic architecture, going to be fully updatable. They're saying it's going to be much more aerodynamic, but they're not really giving us any hints, you know, about what it's going to look like yet. I think at some point it will gradually replace the F-150 or the Lightning, I should say.
The Lightning. Well, that makes sense too, because the Lightning, like you say, the Lightning didn't come out with the last generation of the F-150, kind of came out on its own. So that lets them do a little overlap and then say, we're going to launch our new F-150 and like, wait, we got a new Lightning or something, you know, some other. Yeah.
So then this new plant is going to have capacity for up to 500,000 vehicles a year, which is going to be, like, in terms of capacity, their largest plant in the entire Ford.
What's the Rouge plant or one of those? Do you know
Rouge
what their
plant
capacity
can do?
Is?
Rouge can do about 350, I think.
So that's a huge. A I was just trying to like how much different. That's a huge difference. Okay.
But they're, you know, in terms of number of vehicles they can produce per square foot, they've actually reduced it by about 30%. For the new plant, because they've designed it from the ground up as an EV, they've been able to simplify a lot of things, simplify a lot of processes, simplify the vehicle. It's not as complex to build. One of the things that Farley mentioned in his speech was that, you know, right now for standard F-150s, you know, there are, he said, hundreds of thousands, but I think the number is actually in the millions of buildable combinations of F-150s.
Oh, yeah. I believe it.
For the Lightning, there's 70 buildable combinations because, you know, there's only one body style. It only comes as a dual motor, crew cab, short bed.
Right.
You know, so you get to pick your colors, you get trims, and the battery size. For this new truck, he said there's going to be far fewer than on the Lightning. Basically, they're going to be, when I talked to Lisa Drake, she said, you know, essentially, everything's going to be built into every truck, and then you'll be able to configure it with software. Configure what you want to have with software.
That's kind of cool. Okay.
Yeah. So they're really going all in on this whole software defined vehicle thing. So it's going to be interesting. You know, we'll be learning more about this thing over the next year or two. You know, it's still more than 2 years away from production. You know, by the time this thing gets into production, but Ford is still saying, you know, that they want to be at a 2 million annual run rate for EVs by the end of 2026.
Wow.
And that's a global number. So that includes Europe, China, and North America.
Okay.
I mean, 500,000 just from this one plant that they call Blue Oval City. That's going to be a lot of EVs.
Yeah, it is.
All right. We have one listener question/comment, which came from Brenda. It's kind of a long one. Brenda apparently bought a Jeep Grand Wagoneer, and not long afterwards, there was a technical service bulletin put out by Stellantis. So TSBs are this thing that automakers use when there's something that, you know, is an issue. It's not something that rises to the level of a safety issue that requires a recall of all the vehicles, but, you know, it may affect some or all of the vehicles. And it's generally considered more of an annoyance factor than a safety issue.
Right.
And so they put these out to dealers, to the TSBs, and you can usually look them up. And if a customer brings a car in, you know, complaining of that particular issue, or if the vehicle is coming in just for regular service or maintenance, and, you know, one of the things that the service departments do is they check the TSB database to see if there's anything on that vehicle that needs to be done. And then, you know, they usually do that, and it's covered under warranty. So Brenda says, I hope this message finds you well. I wanted to bring your attention to a concerning issue regarding the 22 Jeep Grand Wagoneer and my recent experience with a local dealership, Cape Coral Jeep Dodge Ram Chrysler. According to the TSB issued in April 2022, potential issue with the vehicle's windshield may cause vertical distortion in the center area of the windshield surface. Unfortunately, my newly purchased Grand Wagoneer exhibited this exact issue just 2 weeks after purchase. After experiencing friction with the dealership's management, I contacted the 1-800 VIP number for assistance in having the defective windshield replaced. However, the dealership initially obfuscated in my attempts to have it replaced and begrudgingly agreed, providing only a loaner vehicle. After 3 days, the dealership called to say that they don't replace glass and instead ordered the replacement to be done at my home. Incredibly, the dealership still released the vehicle back to me with a known safety issue, a distorted windshield. In addition, throughout this process, the VIP Wagoneer Ambassador hotline was worse than useless, providing only further complication and no clarity. I believe this issue is of critical importance to Wagoneer owners and potential buyers. I'm willing to share my experience with you in an interview. So I think, you know, what I would recommend that Brenda do, and anybody else that's in this case, when it comes to warranty issues or any service on a vehicle that you buy, you don't have to take it back to the dealer you bought it from.
Exactly.
You know, anything that's covered under warranty, you can take it to any dealer for that manufacturer. So you can go to any Jeep dealer in the country and say, this needs to be fixed. I want it done. And they will do it for you. In the case of a windshield, a lot of times, the windshield, glass is not necessarily done at dealerships. They're not necessarily equipped to do it. They will often send you to a specialized auto glass place, or, in some cases, do it at home. I mean, I've had a cracked windshield replaced at home in my garage, called Safe Light, and they came out and replaced the windshield. It took like less than half an hour.
I too have had windshields replaced in my driveway, and also where I worked once upon a time, they were allowed to do the, and they just came to the parking lot and the place was okay with it. And they came and they replaced it while I was at work. And, hey, can we have your key? We're going to replace your glass. Here's your key. Your glass is all set. So they do sometimes send people out, like windshield guys, like to do that.
Yeah. So what I would recommend to Brenda and anybody else that may be experiencing this issue with their Wagoneer, if your dealer is giving you a hard time about it, first of all, if they say that they're going to send somebody out, they're going to call a Safe Light or some other place to come out and do it, just have them do that. There's no reason not to. These companies that do auto glass, they specialize in it. They know exactly how to do it. They're going to do it just as well as a dealer is going to do it. I would say, let them do that.
I would say the same thing. I wouldn't hesitate if they're sending out a glass company to replace that. That's a good thing. You're putting an expert in doing that is coming out to replace your windshield, which is they'll do it right.
Yeah. And that's all they do.
Right.
And then more generally, when it comes to things like warranty issues or TSBs or recalls, if you're having a hard time with your dealer, just call another dealer. Yeah. go to another dealer. Don't go back to that dealer, because you don't have to. You can go to any Jeep dealer.
Right.
And it's
frustrating. It's frustrating to think, I bought this in a case of a Grand Wagoneer. That is not a cheap car. You bought an expensive car from a dealership. You're asking them to, fix this problem. And they gave you, they made a little bit difficult for you to do. You know, bring your car in, or we're not going to do it. Oh, no, wait, we're going to send it home. That's annoying. It's totally an annoyance, and one that you really don't want to have to deal with when you're supposed to have better, you know, you've bought a luxury vehicle and there's extra service that Jeep does, you know, that VIP Wagoneer Ambassador, like there's extra stuff they do. But if your dealer's being obnoxious, go to another dealer, like walk away. Same kind of thing you do if you're buying a car. A dealership's being really bad, walk away. There's other places that sell it.
Lots of dealers.
Yeah. And dealers, you know, as much as dealers get a bad rap, and deservedly so in many cases, you know, if they can make you a fan of theirs, if they can treat you right when someone else done you wrong, they'll make an effort to fix it in the hopes that when you need service and you need to go to Jeep, you will go to them instead of the guy who is awful. Or when you need to buy your next car, you will go to them instead of the guy who is awful, which you probably would do. You'll go to the one who treated you right once you spent money on your $100,000 car. So yeah, walk away to another dealership if the service department is giving you heck. And yeah, let them replace the glass at your home if that's something that they're offering to do.
And, you know, unfortunately, I'm sorry to hear that, you know, the ambassador line, you know, the VIP Wagoneer ambassador line is also giving you a hard time. That's not good either.
No, because that's supposed to make your life easier, owning a Wagoneer, not harder.
So. Yeah. So, you know, hopefully, you know, there's somebody at Stellantis listening. I know there's people who work at Stellantis that listen to the show. You know, if you can pass this along to somebody in the Wagoneer team, yeah, let them know. You know, in general, you know, vote with your feet and your dollars.
Absolutely. 100%.
Whether you're buying or just getting service, dealer's giving you a hard time, go find another dealer.
Another dealer. There's plenty of other places that sell and service the car. Yep.
And that's it for this week.
That's it.
Yeah. We'll talk to you next week. If you have any questions, you can email them to feedback@wheelbearings.media. You can put them in the Discord. I'm losing my mind. put them in the Discord, you can send us if you want to record your question or your comment.
Oh, yeah,
you know, send us a recording. You know, record it on your favorite voice recorder app or voice memo or whatever, and just send us a link to it, and we will use that in the show.
Absolutely. Have a good one, guys.
All right. Bye.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.